Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Irish author Maeve Binchy's books make you want to curl up with a warm cup of tea and read for hours. They're about love and loss and community, about friendships and family. There's a wholesome quality to her storytelling that gives you hope for humanity and a clear eye for human nature that keeps her books flying off the shelves. This hour, On Point best-selling Irish author Maeve Binchy. You can join the conversation. Are you part of the Binchy Brigade? What's your question for Maeve Binchy on life, love, Ireland? Joining me now from Dalkey, south of Dublin, is Maeve Binchy, best-selling author, whose books have been translated into more than 40 languages. They include Circle of Friends, which was made into a movie starring Minnie Driver and Chris O'Donnell in 1995, and Tara Road, which put her on Oprah. Her latest is Heart and Soul, set in a Dublin heart clinic. The Times of London says, oh, bliss, just to see it on the shelf. The Boston Globe says, if it were any more heartwarming, you would need ice packs. Maeve Binchy, welcome.
Hello, Tom. It's nice to talk to you.
It's lovely to have you with us. I wonder how you see your own works. People do love to curl up by the fire with your book. There's no getting around it. When you write them, do you see yourself as providing a salve, a balm, escape, or getting in deep? How do you look at it?
Well, I don't really, because I can never really imagine people reading them. When I'm writing, I'm sitting by myself. Well, I'm sitting in 50% by myself in a study because my husband, Gordon Snell, is a children's writer. He writes children's books. And so he sits on the other side of the desk. And we write along happily, both of us in the belief that nobody is ever going to read it. It's almost like a form of therapy. And then it turns out that they do read it and in different languages too, which is astounding. Because when I see my books in Japanese, they look like little small bus timetables. They're very small. And I see them in Hebrew, you begin at the back, and in Arabic, you begin at the back of the book, and in Russian. And I often wonder, how would these people in these countries and these different, entirely different civilizations be interested in what happened to the people that who live in Ireland? But on the other hand, I suppose on a good day, I think to myself, maybe I have got the, I'm just writing about the human condition. And on a bad day, when I don't like what I'm writing, I think maybe I'm just writing blinding glimpses and into the obvious and cliches.
On the other hand, you're not so sequestered away that you don't know that people take comfort somehow in reading your books. How do you interpret that? What do you think people find comforting? It's not as though there aren't difficult things happening. My goodness, you've got, you know, love and death and divorce and families coming together and breaking up, the whole range. Where's the comfort coming?
Well, it's very strange, Tom, but I must explain to you. One time, I speak French exactly the same way as I speak English. Very quickly, without much of a French accent, an entirely Dublin accent. And I was on a French television show, and the host said to me, tell me, madame, what is your philosophy of life? Now, nobody would, you wouldn't ask anybody that, your worst enemy, what your philosophy of life
maybe
is.
Maybe the French would.
The French would, I think. They're wonderful. They do, after all, the children at school do courses in philosophy, whereas we don't, you know, before they leave grade school. So anyway, I had to think quickly because there were 6 million people listening.
Right.
And I couldn't put my thumb into my mouth and say, I don't know, I don't have a philosophy. So I thought quite quickly, and I thought the only thing to do is to tell the truth. And so I said in halting and bad French, whatever hand you're dealt, you've got to play it. Nobody's going to come and rescue you. You are in a way responsible for your own life. You make your own happiness. The cavalry isn't waiting there to come in with flags unfurled. And I was almost afraid to look at the other people on the panel in case they thought it was all so silly. Right. But in fact, they were all nodding. Oui, c'est juste. Yes, they thought it was fine. So I actually thought about it afterwards. I couldn't sleep that night. I was so overexcited. I thought, that is my philosophy. You know, nobody ever asked it to me before. I think we are in charge of our own lives. And I think that does provide a bit of comfort to people. They do think, maybe I can make the best of whatever hand I was dealt, and people who do in my books win. You see, my books are not makeover books. People don't become thin. Fat people don't become thin. Mm. And poor people don't become rich. Mm-hmm. And single people don't necessarily become married. And because I looked around me once and I often saw a lot of thin, rich, married people who were absolutely miserable. Mm. So that wasn't the solution. None of those three things were the solution. The solution was somehow taking control of your own life and doing what you could do best for yourself and hopefully for others as well.
Give us a sense of it by telling us something about your new book, Heart and Soul. It's set in Dublin in a heart clinic. Give us a sense of what you're up to here, Maeve Binchy.
Well, I used to go to a heart clinic. I mean, I still do go to a heart clinic every 4 weeks. If you had any heart trouble, you can go and they keep an eye on you. They sort of monitor you. And I used to come home and I used to say to my husband, Gordon, every month, oh, God, you could write a book about that place. It's absolutely astounding, that place. There's 100 stories there, and they're all one more entertaining than the next, the people. And I think out of desperation, he said, well, why don't you write a book about it? So I decided it was a very good place to set a story, because everybody who comes there in a slight sense of tension, they're, you know, nobody's at ease when they're told there's something wrong with their heart. They think, you know, that's a dangerous sort of thing to happen. And so I met lots of people, but we all, you know, over the last few months, we've all been talking about things like the world recession and Obama's chances in America and games and sports. Nobody's talking about pains and aches or anything like that. So I decided to write a book about the people who run a heart clinic and give people a lot of confidence to live their life quite normally, and the various people who come in as patients and who work in it. And it proved a very easy way, because you see, when you're writing a story, you have to have a reason why all these people meet each other. You can't suddenly say, and then she went out on the road and she met a total stranger and this happened. You have to have some reason why they're all together. And so Heart and Soul is about these people who are constantly coming up and turning up over and over again. And for the first time in one of my books, I decided that I would actually bring in lots of people who have been in my previous books, whom the readers seem to have liked. And they often wrote to me and said, whatever happened to Signora, a character from Evening Class? Mm. And whatever happened to the twins, who are characters from a book called Quentin's? Whatever happened to the restaurant Quentin's? And whatever happened to Fiona from The Knights of Rain and Stars? What happened to her when she came back to be a nurse again in Ireland? So I brought a lot of those people in again. And I'm very pleased, because a lot of readers have said it's like meeting old friends again. You suddenly catch up on them and you say, oh, that's where they are now. So I'm very pleased that it went very well in Europe and in Britain. And I'm thrilled that it's been published in America, and that the United States have had it just around St. Patrick's Day as an added bonus.
Maeve Binchy's new book is Heart and Soul. I was struck. Yes, there are old friends back here for your long-time readers. But there's also very significant sort of timeliness or currency in the twists on all these characters. There's something quite contemporary about almost each and every one of them. They're not exactly timeless, and you must be very aware of that. You've got your immigrant character. You've got, well, take us on down the line and the sort of current quality that you've given to most of these characters.
Well, I suppose I learned a lovely lesson once when I was in the Irish Times. I worked in the Irish Times as a woman editor. Mm. And I had sent various people out. I'm not at all good as a general. I'm much better as a private, you know, in the army, really. I'm not at all good at giving orders and delegating. And I had sent somebody out to do a job and she didn't do it. And she rang up and said she'd fallen amongst friends and that she wasn't coming home. So I had to fill a quarter of a page terribly quickly, very quickly, without letting the powers upstairs know that there was anything wrong. And I wrote an article saying, this is many years ago, saying that the first time I stayed in a hotel, I didn't know whether you ever made the bed or not, you see, because we'd never stayed in a
was
hotel.
Was that your job or not?
Or should you make your own bed? And if you did make the bed, maybe it meant that you were too humble, a servant-class person, and that you didn't have a place in a hotel. Mm. And if you didn't make the bed, maybe you were a slut and a tramp and they wouldn't let you back when you
or
came
arrogant.
Back.
Mm-hmm.
Or arrogant. Or arrogant. Exactly. So I just folded the bed up and sort of turned it back neatly. And to my amazement, that all the lovely heart-searching articles I was writing at the time as a women's liberation, nothing that I wrote was so popular as that article. There were thousands of letters saying how wonderful it was, because people had felt the same. And in fact, there were a lot of the letters saying, what do you do, for people who are still not quite sure? So I thought to myself, when I started writing novels, I would have characters who are never sure or secure of themselves in themselves, because I weary sometimes reading books of people who are very beautiful and who are very wealthy and have a hugely posh lifestyle that the rest of us don't have. And I just thought, well, you know, why not talk about the anxieties, particularly of the young, when you're not quite certain of what the right thing to do is. And I do that, put that in quite a lot. And in Heart and Soul also I have quite a lot about the new Irish, the people who came when we were very wealthy, when we had that short-lived and very exciting time when we were called the Celtic Tiger, when everybody in Ireland seemed very wealthy, except of course the wealth was not divided equally. It wasn't everybody that was wealthy. A group of people became very wealthy. There was high employment, and people came from all over Europe and Africa to come and work with us. This was such a shock, because in Ireland we never had other people coming to work here. We weren't a colonial power, for one thing, not like England or Belgium or France or Germany, who had colonies abroad, and so the people felt that we were the motherland in any way. And so there was nobody, not worth anyone's time coming to Ireland, because there weren't enough jobs for the Irish. We were all busy taking the boat to the United States or to Australia or to England. And so it was such an extraordinary few years when suddenly we were rich, and lots of young people came into Ireland to look for jobs. And I live in a place called Dalkey, which is 10 miles south of Dublin. And, you know, in all the restaurants and the pubs and the shops in Dalkey, there were lots of Croatian and Polish and Serbian girls working there. As it was so nice to see some new people, which we didn't see before. It had to do good for us all.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Ireland's great curl-up-by-the-fire storyteller, Maeve Binchy, about Irish life in boom and bust, and her latest book, Heart and Soul. She's had so many out, nearly 20 now, bestseller after bestseller. Some have gone to the movies. Here's a little bit from the 1995 film version of her book, Circle of Friends. Jack Foley, played by Chris O'Donnell, is discovering he really likes Benny Hogan, played by Minnie Driver.
It's easy to talk to you. You know that? I feel as if I could tell you anything. Very solid, aren't you?
Yes. Everyone notices that. Solid. Beef to the heels like a Mullingar heifer.
No. I didn't mean that. I meant, you're really there. You really know who you are, don't you?
Well, yes. Of course I do.
Sometimes I feel as if I'm hardly there at all. Just trying to be things for other people.
Beef to the heels like a Mullingar heifer. You know you're not in Kansas anymore. With Maeve Binchy, her new book is Heart and Soul. She joins us today from her home in Dalkey near Dublin. Maeve Binchy, it's such a pleasure to have you with us. And we've got listeners who want to speak to you from Lake Placid, New York. Elizabeth is calling. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air with Maeve Binchy.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, you're on.
Oh, well, I am so pleased. I have your book in front of me, and believe me, I have followed with everyone. My mother came from Ireland. I'm 84 years old, and you are bringing to life. Every time I read a passage or even a chapter, I think back to my childhood and my mother, and my aunts and uncles, too, that came from there. So all I can do is thank you. Thank
well,
you, thank
Elizabeth,
you.
Elizabeth, this is lovely news to hear, because it's very nice when you can find something that people can relate to. Have you been back to Ireland yourself?
No, I always wanted to go, but never could afford it. But, you know, I mean...
You're only 84. You come back
right,
here
right,
soon.
Right, get going. Kick up your heels, Elizabeth. What is it about Maeve Binchy, Elizabeth, that keeps you coming back to her books? Apart from your sort of attachment, maybe sentimental, to Ireland, what about the books themselves?
Well, the books themselves explain it. I'm carried to my mother's way of thinking, her actions, her love, and the rest of the family, too, the O'Keefe's their name were. And it brings me where I couldn't go. I could never afford to get there, but it brings me there. I did keep in touch with cousins over there, and that helped, too. And I also wore an apron that a cousin sent me on St. Patrick's Day, where my family came to my St. my corned beef and cabbage dinner. But the point that I'm trying to make is she brings it to life for me.
That's great.
I'm living it again. I'm living my mother's days and her feelings. And she does that. She captures it.
No other writer did.
I'm very pleased to hear this because one of the things that really gives me a great deal of pleasure is that there seem to be people of all generations who seem to enjoy it. Because when Circle of Friends came out as a movie, I was terribly grateful to the people who made that film because they brought me to a young audience. Most because, you see, when you see my picture on the back of the book, well, I look what I am, a woman in her 60s. I don't look like as if I'd understand about love and desire and need and misunderstanding and all the rest.
Danielle Steele is not a spring chicken, but she's all gussied up. I'm not sure how she
looks gorgeous on her books. She looks absolutely lovely. She's quite different. Yeah. But I was afraid that people might think this is a book for my mother or my grandmother. But in fact, after Circle of Friends, I got quite a lot of young people reading them. But what's also very nice is for me is I don't write about graphic sex descriptions. This is not because I'm a terribly good and moral person. I'm reasonably good and I'm reasonably moral, but I would die with embarrassment rather write about sex. I couldn't do it because
it entirely. There's plenty of sex tucked into this latest Heart and Soul.
There's plenty of sex, but it's not described lingeringly. Yeah. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's described and what the results of sex and the delight of it to people, but it's not described move by move because I'd be afraid. I've never been to an orgy or anything like that, so I would get it wrong. I think that people get on chandeliers and on coffee tables and things. And I'm sure I'd have the people in the wrong order and people would laugh at it. Yeah. And in England, they have an amazing thing called the Bad Sex Award, people who write sex scenes so badly that they get an award for it. So I'm afraid I'd win
that. Don't want to be the winner. What about Elizabeth saying, you take her back to her mother, memories of maybe even grandmother? How much of your readership, if you know, do you have this feeling, is Irish diaspora, Irish, you know, who have emigrated and now reading back through you to the old country?
Well, I think a fair amount in the English-speaking editions of the books, in the English-language editions of the books, I think a fair number of them might have begun by having some Irish connection. But they tell their friends about it. And very often I get letters from people in the United States telling me that their background is Danish or Mexican or Polish, and yet they still seem to identify with the story. And then, of course, there are all the other languages which the book is translated, which I was talking to a friend of mine who's a lovely practical guy who doesn't allow me away with any nonsense, and I was showing him the Korean edition of my book. I've never been to Korea, and I said, imagine in Korea they're reading about this. And he says, well, I suppose they have the same problems in Korea as we do here. Fellas who want to be a bit free and women who want them to marry them and settle down, and people who want to live in big cities like Seoul with shining lights rather than living in small, awful little villages. Sure, they're probably just the same over there as we are ourselves. And suddenly that put it all into some kind of perspective, because there's more people that unites us all than divides us, really.
But beef to the heels like a mullingar heifer. I wonder how that translates in Korean.
Well, I'd love to know. But it was
a stocky girl, I guess.
Stocky girl, it's a fattish thing. When people would say slightly disparagingly about someone if they were fat, they'd say she was beef to the heels, which meant that there were, you know, in other words, she didn't have little thin hoofs or whatever it'd be. But a mullingar heifer was always very solid.
Kathleen's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Kathleen, you're on the air with Maeve Binchy.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to thank Maeve Binchy for helping me out when my first daughter was born, who is named Maeve. We picked that name out. And I remember I told my family, who is all Irish from, you know, every which way, and I said, oh, what are you going to name the baby? I said, we're going to name her Maeve. And I got a lot of, what kind of name is that? I've never heard. And finally my grandmother, whose parents were both from County Mayo, she said, oh, you mean like Maeve Binchy, the author from Ireland? I said, right, exactly. And so then other family members say, Maeve, what kind of name is that? I would say, like Maeve Binchy, the Irish author. And
so a little credibility for your choice.
Yes, they sort of rescued me from this, you know, the feeling that I was, you know, saddling my child with some strange name.
I'm delighted to hear that. And, you know, if you send me, you can write to my website and send me your address. I'll send your Maeve a birthday card.
Oh, because that would be lovely.
I will, seriously, because I have no children of my own, but I have five little American girls called Maeve, and I send them all a birthday card every year because I'm so pleased because their mothers say that they call them after me.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Straight to Maeve Binchy. I should say, by the way, you can also read an excerpt of her latest book, Heart and Soul, at our website, onpointradio.org. And good luck to your little Maeve, Kathleen. Let me get to Joe in Providence, Rhode Island. Joe, you're on the air with Maeve Binchy.
Hello, Tom. Dear Gooch and Maeve.
Dear Gooch, Tom. Joe, sorry.
That's okay. Just a quick question for you. In the past few years, we've seen, you know, a real screeching halt with the Celtic Tiger and the beginnings of a real serious recession. I was wondering where you saw Ireland's future and, more importantly, what kind of stories you saw coming forth now.
Well, there certainly is a serious recession, which is a world one, and we're part of it. We're awfully interested to see what's happening in your country because everybody is watching, because you seem to have more hope than the rest of us do in Europe because you have a completely new person with a new ideas. And I hope, you know, I hope for your sake and for all our sakes that America is going to get back on its feet again. And what you have is a sense of youth and hope. We don't quite have that, but we're all decided the first shock is over now. We've decided we've got to be sensible, and all the newspapers are full of ways of saving money, of people gathering together in groups and cooperatives, of trying to make the best of things. It is bringing out what they used to have in Britain, was called the Blitz spirit, when people were in London were all terribly friendly to each other during the bombings during the last World War. And there is a much greater understanding between people at the moment. Everybody is so delighted when you come to Ireland, and I don't work for the Irish Tourist Board, not at all, but when you come to Ireland, I think you get a much better welcome now than you might have a few years ago, because there are fewer people travelling and people make a fuss of you. I have American friends, and they came to Ireland just about 3 weeks ago, and they said that people were practically coming out of the street and making sure they were having a good time and directing them to places. So, I mean, maybe there's some more warmth developing in us when we realise we're not such hotshots as we thought we were.
I want to get more on the economy, what it was like in the boom and now the bust. Let me get, Joe, thank you for your call. Let me get one more here from Anne in Norfolk, Virginia. Anne, you're on with Maeve Binchy.
Hello, Maeve. Thank you. I'm on my way driving to Norfolk, Virginia to settle my mother's estate. She died a year and a half ago. And when we divided up all her belongings, I wanted the Maeve Binchy books because my mother has read so many of your books, and I have about 10 of them waiting to read them. And the fact that I'm listening and just was flipping around on the radio and happened on your interview, to me, is just providential. I'm just so moved by it because it's been a difficult journey losing my 82-year-old mother, and now just the fact that I can listen to you as I'm driving to settle her estate today at 2:00 is really, for me, something so moving, and I'm so happy to read the books when I get back. I'm going to start in them right away. And my mother was a feisty, determined, intelligent woman, and I really feel like I'm going to grasp that from your book. So is there anything you can tell me when I start the first book? What should I look for?
Well,
that's good.
That's very nice of you to say that, and it's a horrible time. I know my mother died a long time ago, and it's a very poignant time of memories and of seeing little things that upset you every single time. You know, I think in my case, when I found my mother's glasses, I don't know why, I found just her spectacles, that was the most upsetting thing. I had managed not to cry for a few days, and I found it terribly sad because it just sort of the vulnerability of it seemed very sad. You've just got to keep your head down and keep at it and know that this is what she would want you to do. In my own stories, they're all of different times. The first one I wrote was called Light a Penny Candle, and that was set longer ago. And then I decided to become more modern, and and to bring it right up to date. And so I have there's about 20 of them there. There's an awful lot of them. People ask you which is your favourite book, and I would say truthfully that your last book is your favourite. Not just because you want to sell it. That's not the thing. It's just that it's the most familiar. I'm terribly familiar with all the people in Heart and Soul, with Clara, the doctor, a heart specialist, who comes into this heart clinic, which she doesn't want to be in. She regards it as a complete background to go to. She didn't want it a bit. And she says, "Which okay, I'll grit my teeth and I'll do it for a year." And it's really, the book is about the year where she's there. And of course, you know, and I know, because she's so strong, she's going to make something of it, and she does. And the various other people, Declan, the marvellous young doctor who's very nervous and very anxious, and Fiona, the beautiful nurse who had had a dreadful, sad love affair before that had gone so wrong, and Johnny, the physiotherapist, and Lavender, the dietitian, all the people who work there, each one with their own story. And there's a story of Hillary, whose mother has Alzheimer's disease, but she doesn't want to put her in a home, and she's trying ineffectually to try and run a job and look after her mother at the same time. So if you like, all human life is there, and I think you might like Heart and Soul, because it's not that I'm trying to get you to read the new one, it's just that I feel very often that you're very familiar to it, and I know all the people. I actually know them as if they're friends of mine. And I don't know whether you'd believe this or not, but when I used to interview, I was a journalist, and I used to run the women's page in the Irish Times. And when I used to go out and interview people, writers, sometimes I would interview an author, and the author would say, "My characters are like real people to me." And I wanted to say, "Pass me the sick bag. This is a very sad person if she thinks her characters are like real people to her." In fact, I'm afraid it goes with the territory. Maybe I've become mad too, but my characters do seem like real people to me. And I keep thinking there's one I really like, a guy called Declan, and he's such a decent young man who's going to be a general practitioner, and he's doing 6 months in the heart clinic.
Yeah.
And he's such a nice boy, and I'd love him to have a nice life. So maybe all authors go mad in the end.
No, I don't think so, but you're wrapped up with it, and there's a deep taste for you, straight from Maeve Binchy. Thanks for calling. Maeve, I can't help think, but feel sort of Anne's, that little snapshot out of her life there is something like that would be in one of your books. A woman on the way to settle her mother's estate and hears on the radio an author that she, her mother adores, and soon we're down in the weave of it, which is where you take us again and again and again. It's not sort of glorious swashbuckling. It's all the day in and day out that you somehow make so fascinating.
Well, you know, everybody has, you can always remember some bad review of yourself, you know, you always remember, and it rankles in your mind.
Of course.
But I remember a good review that somebody said of my books once, so I remember this. In fact, I typed it out and I put it in a little frame on top of my desk so that I could remember it. It was, somebody said that I always had discovered that life is never dull if you know where to look. And that is actually true. I mean, it doesn't sound like a huge statement that would change your life, but life is never dull if you kind of look through the people and look beyond them. And so if I'm at an airport or at a railway station, I look at this couple who are going, he's saying, "I thought you had the tickets," and she's saying, "I thought you had the tickets." And they're both screeching at each other in bad temper. And you think, imagine these two people are going on a holiday together for 2 weeks to a hotel. And before they've even left the country, they're practically, ready for the divorce courts. There's a little story in everything that you see.
A little story in everything. No kidding.
There is.
And you sew them together wonderfully. We're going to go out of this section with no less than the music, as I understand it, Maeve, that you've chosen to have played at your own funeral, may it be many years from now, but by Piper Liam O'Flynn. Why this piece, Maeve Binchy?
Well, I love the Brendan Voyage. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of music, and I just think it's very tear jerking. And I don't want people to be cheerful. I want them to be absolutely unwilling to be consoled with grief when I go, which I hope will be in many years' time.
Inconsolable is the order here. Maeve Binchy in Dalkey, Ireland. Please stand by. Maeve Binchy's new book is Heart and Soul. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Ireland's great curl-up by the fire storyteller Maeve Binchy about Irish life in boom and bust and her latest book, her new book, Heart and Soul. She joins us today from Dalkey, Ireland, just outside Dublin. Here's a little bit more from Circle of Friends, the movie version of her book, came out in 1995. Here, Jack Foley, played by Chris O'Donnell, is athletic, smart, and comes from a good family. He gets plenty of attention from women. But the one he's most interested in, Benny Hogan, played by Minnie Driver, isn't the classic beauty. Here's Jack's father encouraging him, from Maeve Binchy's book in the movie, to pursue his heart.
There's a lot to be said for these big, soft girls, you know? That one had a nice, soft look about her. Nice eyes. Beautiful hair. Lovely smile. Fine set of teeth on her.
You don't miss much, do you, Dad?
I do not.
Tony Doyle plays the father there, and the son notices that the father notices a lot. That from Circle of Friends. Maeve Binchy's latest book is Heart and Soul. She joins us from Dalkey, Ireland. Maeve, I wonder if you would read just a bit for us from the new book. You were talking about the young doctor, ginger-haired, red-haired Declan. There's a passage where he's just got up the nerve to ask the beautiful Fiona, who works for him at the heart clinic, to go on a date, and he's surprised. She says yes, even more surprised when they end up going to the elegant Quentin's restaurant. Would you mind reading for us a bit?
Certainly, because this is exactly what I mean about the sort of vulnerability of young people when they're not completely sure of themselves. I'll read this now. Declan cycled home that day on a route that took him past Quentin's restaurant. It looked very imposing. Declan wondered, was he quite mad to have suggested this place? With any luck, they might be full, and he could honestly tell Fiona that he had tried. But no, when he called them from his mobile phone around the corner, it turned out that they could easily find a table for two. So he booked it with a very heavy heart. Perhaps he should go in and examine it, give himself some hint of the familiarity that he had claimed with the place. He pushed the door open. It was quite busy. There was a good value early bird dinner there for people who were on their way to the theatre. A handsome, middle-aged woman, who seemed very much in charge, approached him. She was about to find him a table, but Declan's mother's shepherd's pie would shortly be on the table at home. No, excuse me, I was just coming in to have a look. You see, I have never been here before, but I have invited someone to dinner. He realised that he sounded like a madman coming in from the street. This woman would probably ask him to leave and never allow him to be readmitted. What a fool he had been to come in here and see the lay of the land. But yet she seemed to accept his behaviour as normal. Well, of course you want to have a look at the place. Let me take you on a quick tour. I'm Brenda Brennan, by the way, and my husband Patrick is the chef here. We'd be delighted to show you around. I'm Declan Carroll, he said, hardly daring to believe that he'd been reprieved. Yes, of course, Mr. Carroll, you rang a few moments ago. Let me show you the table that I had in mind for you. Dazed, he followed her from the oyster bar with all its crushed ice to the dessert display with its fruit cascades tumbling from little pillars. She pointed out the restrooms. She took him into the kitchen to meet Patrick. Dazed by it all, he thanked her and said how much he was looking forward to Thursday. You are very kind, Mrs. Brennan, to take me on this tour. I'm afraid I'm not what you'd call experienced at all this fine dining. Oh, few of us are, Mr. Carroll, but even fewer have the sense to admit it. Is this a big occasion on Thursday? It is for me. I've asked a most attractive girl out for the first time. I hope it'll be a success. Well, we'll do our best to make sure it is. Brenda Brennan saw him off at the door, as if he was a regular and honoured client. She saw him getting on his bicycle and heading off happily into the traffic.
Maeve Binchy, reading there from her new book, Heart and Soul, joining us today from Dalkey, Ireland, just outside Dublin. And it's all the little touches of domesticity there, and at the same time, all the passion of love, apprehension, as you say, young people not sure quite how to go about it all.
Well, I think we've all been through these dreadful scenes in our lives, and I think it's somehow reassuring if you know that other people have as well. If you know that Declan and Fiona, who are both terrific people, you know, are terribly nervous about going to this rather posh restaurant, and it's nice to meet a very kind woman, maitre d' or front of house person who is able to put them at their ease.
So many who want to speak with you from Boston, Martin. Martin, you're on the air with Maeve Binchy.
Hi, Maeve. Pardon me. Hi, Maeve. I was going to ask a question about the immigration. The Prime Minister Cowen came over and met Obama
and asked him to, you know, allow more visas. So it seems like the Irish people I've known that gone back, they're kind of lost their jobs after making money, going back to Ireland. So it seems like that's the new thing. And then just a second question. When I heard you read that, it just reminded me when I was in high school, Araby by James Joyce. And I'll take my answer off the air, but I know that you're not far from Dunleary. And can you tell about the influence of the Dubliners on your work? Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. Well,
that's very nice of you, Martin, to call in. I'm delighted to talk to you. Yes, there is a definite problem. We would love there to be more room in America for our people to go there. But like everybody else, we have to wait our turn. They can't give visas to everybody in the world. We hope that a lot of the situations that are irregular can be regularized from Irish people who have been there working very hard and want to be part of their host community properly. I hope that will work out. And of course, you see, don't forget that Barack Obama's great-great-great-grandfather came from County Offaly in Ireland, and it's a small and not very important county in the middle of Ireland. I'm glad I'm speaking to America rather than Ireland at this stage, in case there are too many Offaly people right. listening. But it's such a boost for the people in County Offaly. They're delighted, and they're getting ready for his visit straight away. And we're all very disappointed that Brian Cowan is coming back without a definite date for Mr. Obama's visit to Ireland, because they're waiting for him there. But you see, we feel that once he sees his roots in Ireland and he sees that some of the countryside that he came from, that he'll be opening up the floodgates and letting us all rush off to America to make money. So when times are better, maybe this will happen. But going back to James Joyce, I do indeed only live about 2 miles away from the famous Joyce Tower, which is a marvellous place for people to come and see when they come to Ireland, which is the opening of Ulysses, of Joyce's his extraordinary book about Dublin. Mm. When it opens, it's in this tower it's Joyce and his friends are gathered there together, being lofty and well read, standing there talking. It can hardly have changed a bit. It's a Joyce museum there now. My own influence is not. Traceable to anybody, because I actually don't write like anybody else. I just write as I talk, and I talk very quickly, and I when I begin a sentence, I don't know how the sentence is going to end. In fact, I mistrust people who know how their sentences are going to end. I think if somebody knows how their sentence is going to end, they're being somehow cunning and devious. I write exactly the same way. I don't put in any punctuation much. I've never put in a semicolon or I forget commas.
Hooray for editors, then, I guess.
Yeah, well, as I just say, editors have jobs too, and I just think to myself, you know, we shouldn't cross the lines. Let the editors do their jobs, and I always accept their correction. So I've never written like anyone. All I do is try to tell a story. It's like when I'm telling you about Declan, that piece I read there. I want to say there's this boy Declan, and he went into this restaurant quiz, and he was so nervous. And this is, I'm just telling it like a story. I'm not doing a style. And if I have one criticism of Americans, it's that sometimes they are too impressed by other people, and they take, for example, a lot of young American people I know, people's children of my friends, they're studying the works of Jane Austen or of Margaret Atwood or of Doris Lessing or whatever it is. I would read them, yes, but I wouldn't study them, because you don't want to write like them. You want to write like them yourself if you're telling a story. And the art of storytelling, it can never be underestimated. And people love a story.
Just open your own mouth and sing, in a way.
That's it, really, in a way. That is exactly it, you know, Tom. Yeah. If you do that to tell the story, it's, first of all, it doesn't sound contrived. And, you know, when you meet, if ever you go to a gathering and you meet somebody who's a little bit studied and mannered, you don't come away with the same feeling of pleasure at having met them as you would if you met somebody who was enthusiastic and spoke about what was near and dear to them and spoke with an eagerness and a rush of eagerness. I love that in a person.
Maeve Binchy, there's a rush of people who want to speak with you. I just want to try and get some more on. There's so many here. Barbersville, Virginia, Joe. Joe, you're on the air with Maeve Binchy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
Thank you for taking my call. I just got back from Ireland, and I had not been there for 20 years since my mother died. And the thing that struck me the most this trip was that I knew more about Irish history than everybody I talked to in Ireland, and I went all over the north, all over the south.
Are you an historian, Joe?
I'm not a historian at all. It's just that I have a friend who studied Gaelic at Harvard and got me interested in the Irish language to the point of seeing plays in Dublin in Gaelic and in Harvard play translations.
But, and you wonder if they're, forgetting, ignoring their own history in Ireland?
Well, it's just that I would ask them things about historic facts that I knew, and nobody seemed to know anything, and nobody seemed to care. And I don't know if it's because of the Celtic Tiger syndrome, but it's like nobody cared about history, and I was a little bit saddened by that.
Joe, let us pick it up, wondering if the good times are actually part of a little memory erasure. Miv Binchy, how about it?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you may have met people, who were bone ignorant, who didn't know anything about them. This is quite possible. I admit about my own country. And I was a history teacher at school. I taught history. So I was always disappointed when people didn't know more about history. It may have been, there's another thing you have to factor into it. It's 10 years since the peace process, just 10 years. It's an extraordinary length of time. And maybe we try not to raise too many stories of the 800 years of oppression of England, of Ireland, of this country, because everything in the peace process means that we have to have, everybody has to make a bit of a compromise, both sides do. And there's no point in wallowing anymore and singing anti-English songs and thinking we'd all be all fine if they had never been in our country. And the unionist tradition have to feel the same too, because they have to work with a Republican tradition. So maybe that's one of the things. But I actually think, sadly, that what you see, your own interpretation, that it might be due to the Celtic Tiger, is probably true.
The boom times.
The boom times. You see, when people did have these things, I can tell you this, my own cousin was going to get a new kitchen, and during the height of the Celtic Tiger, and she rang a kitchen manufacturer, and he said to her the following phrase, which seemed to sum it all up for me. He said to her, yes, madam, I would say, we're going to have nothing under £100,000. We're doing nothing under £100,000, and there's a 3-year waiting list.
Whoa.
Now that was not the island that I grew up in, and it's not the island of today, of 2009. Let me tell you, they would be down on their hands and knees, delighted to do it. But these people were so amazing. £100,000 for a kitchen, and that'd be about $200,000 to do up a new kitchen. Right. It's insane in this country, where our grandfathers and great grandfathers came from little cottages, which were pretty blinded by the smell of peat smoke in them, and to think that suddenly we were spending this kind of money. I think it did distract people. And I think you might indeed be right thinking that maybe that's why they didn't know their history. But I hope that when you come the next time, maybe we might have smartened up a bit.
Remembered a bit. In Milton, Massachusetts, Catherine, you're on the air with Maeve Binchy.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Maeve.
Hi, Catherine.
Tom. First of all, I love your show. I listen all the time, and I'm delighted that you have Maeve on today. Maeve, I want to say, first of all, I'm Irish, as you can tell by my accent. I have lived here for 20 years. The Lilac Bus is still one of my favorite books. I absolutely loved that book. I love the way you got us into the characters, their lives, everything. I absolutely loved it. And my question or comment would be, a lot of your earlier books were based on, rural characters, and that's the other thing I wanted to say about your books. I absolutely loved all of the characters I can remember to this day, but most of your earlier books had rural settings, rural characters. Nowadays, I find that your more recent books are set, and the other thing, the characters and your books are set around very wealthy business people. Everybody in your books is very well off nowadays. And this probably follows on the last comment, too. How has the economy and the booming economy influenced the way that you write and influenced your finding your characters? Do you not see those characters anymore? Or the people that you based your characters, for example, on the Lilac Bus, do you not see those people? Do those people not exist anymore in Ireland? Or is everybody just, waiting in the the oyster bar for their table in the restaurant.
Right. Catherine, our time is short. Maeve Binch, we've got a minute. What do you say to Catherine?
Very quickly, Catherine, I know what you're talking about, but you'll notice I'm not speaking from the point of view of these wealthy people. I'm speaking of the point of view of the people who are stunned by it. I mean, in the little extract I read, Declan was horrified by this posh place because he felt so out of place there. And a lot of the point of view of people is still the same. The countryside has changed. It wasn't as simple and undemanding as rural, and it wasn't as brigadoonish or how are things in Glocamara as it used to be even when I was young. It's changed. Every town looks more or less the same now, and people move and drive around the place and move from their town to the city. So the countryside has changed, and I think I'm trying to reflect that.
Reflect it, and I mean, in this case, you've certainly got poverty in heart and soul. It's not as if it's absent from the story this time.
Absolutely, in heart and soul, a lot of people are poor, and a lot of people are struggling to make do. And I think that's where my heart is more, with people who are trying hard to make their lives a happy one, because it's a very short time from the old cradle to the grave.
Well, we're on the far side of the Celtic Tiger now, I guess. Maeve Binchy's new book is Heart and Soul. She joined us today from a home, no less, in Dalkey, Ireland, and we're very grateful for that. Maeve, thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for the new book, and thank you very much for spending a little time with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it so much, and I hope readers will like the story.
Thank you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, where you can also read an excerpt from Heart and Soul, the latest book from Maeve Binchy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.